Cities and counties would have to prove the need for traffic cameras on major highways under new rules approved this week. What does it mean for the future of traffic cameras? It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, an update on the Farm Bill, along with other ag news from IPR's Amy Mayer. Iowa's Attorney General urging the FDA to reconsider its approval of a powerful new narcotic painkiller. Gazette sports reporter Mark Morehouse with a preview of the Hawkeyes versus LSU Tigers matchup for the Outback Bowl on New Year's Day. And we'll try to find out why it feels like mid-January, even though it's only mid-December. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our Friday News Buzz edition, where we like to take a handful of new developments in the news in Iowa and have short conversations about them. First off, new developments on an issue that excites passions on both sides of a debate, traffic cameras. Cities and counties would have to prove the need for traffic enforcement cameras on major highways, this under rules approved earlier this week by the Iowa Transportation Commission. The new rules could take effect as early as February, and they would force a reevaluation of all speeding and red light cameras now placed on interstate highways, U.S. highways, and state highways, and require any new cameras to first win the Department of Transportation's approval. Joining me now to discuss the new rules, Steve Gent, Director of Traffic and Safety at the Iowa Department of Transportation. Steve, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there, Ben.
Okay, let's talk about this. Even though traffic cameras are installed and maintained by local governments, the state DOT has ultimate jurisdiction, right?
That's true. On the primary highway system, you just mentioned it, on the interstates, the U.S. routes, and the Iowa routes, those routes, the department is responsible.
Mm-hmm. What are the concerns these new rules are meant to address?
Well, I think the biggest issue really is that, Iowa is extremely unique in the sense that any city or county can get automated traffic enforcement cameras by a simple majority of their city council or county board of supervisors. And that is extremely unique. In fact, I think it's the only state in the nation that allows that simple of a process to happen. In fact, I've been told by the vendors that Iowa is a hotbed for new automated enforcement cameras for that exact reason.
Mm-hmm. So you mean the companies that supply these, they see Iowa as really a Wild West?
Oh, absolutely. Because, well, there's somewhere around 15, maybe 16, 17, 18 states that don't allow any automated speed or red light running cameras at all. And then there's some that allow red light running cameras but not speed cameras, and other ones that have to go through a very defined process. Some have to go through the state DOT. And again, Iowa is just really unique where any city or county can make that decision simply by a majority vote.
Mm-hmm. On this program, we've discussed traffic cameras, red light cameras, speed cameras many times. Now, the concerns that pop up when we discuss this here on Iowa Public Radio are, for instance, people will call in and talk about the fact that they're not stopped by a law enforcement officer. You get photographed, then you get a bill, a fine in the mail, or because these cameras are seen as revenue generators for local governments that install them. Are these new rules also meant to allay these concerns?
Only partially. I think the real reason that we have these the new rules, or we're working on these new rules, they're not implemented yet. The earliest they would go into effect would be February. The real reason is we want to make sure that there's a real safety concern out there, and if there's a safety concern out there, and this is the appropriate traffic safety countermeasure, then that's great. But if there are other safety countermeasures that could or should be installed or implemented, we want to make sure, as a state, that those are also considered and implemented.
So how will safety be proved? It's easy to see perhaps existing cameras, speed cameras, such as the one that I think was discussed on Tuesday at your meeting. Amy Reisner, a commissioner from Cedar Rapids, pointed to a speed camera along Interstate 80 that runs through that curve by the Quaker Oats there in Cedar Rapids, a notorious stretch now made much safer by speed cameras. I believe that's not doubted at all. On an existing one, you can look at statistics. How will it be proved for ones that have yet to be introduced when no speed camera exists?
Yeah, part of the proposed rules basically require an engineering safety analysis. And Ben, this is exactly what we do anytime we change a speed limit, anytime we consider putting in a traffic signal, anytime we're thinking about putting in a right turn or left turn lane. Now, there's a different process for each of those. But there's always a process where you look at the crashes, you look at the speeds, you look at the turning movements. If there's a traffic signal there, you may want to look at the timings. There's all kinds of safety and factual, really it's about gathering the facts and then determining what the real critical traffic safety issue is. And that's the point of doing that sort of analysis, is coming down to the fact of saying, okay, here's the problem because we've looked at all of these things and clearly people are not seeing these oncoming vehicles, or they're being rear-ended at this location and we need, X or Y or Z. So once you find out the critical traffic safety issue, then you can come up with a whole list of safety countermeasures. And Ben, there are always many potential countermeasures to any problem. Mm-hmm. And, we believe that automated traffic enforcement cameras certainly is and can be one of those countermeasures, but it's not the only one. And it's a concern in the sense that they're intrusive, they're controversial, and from a societal perspective, they really are expensive. Well, and that's why, we generally, and this is what government should be doing, we should be looking at low-cost countermeasures. When there's a problem, we should try to fix it in a simple way that doesn't cost people, financially, I guess.
I know there was talk that these new set of rules is, in fact, a ban in disguise. I guess we'll see how that develops in the future. What can you say to that charge?
Well, it's simply not true. And our director, Paul Trombino, he was asked that directly at the commission meeting that you referenced earlier. It was on Tuesday. And that's not the reason for these. The reason is really let's make sure that these are out there for the right reason, that there's a real safety issue. And safety is all about crashes. I mean, we want to look and see, if there are crashes before, and then once the camera's in, what are the crashes afterwards, and if they've been in for several years, how are those crashes maintained over time?
Mm-hmm. I know a real critic of the new rules, Davenport Police Chief, who was very, very concerned in your meeting about the fact that these new rules might force the removal of cameras in his city, cameras that have reduced accidents and saved lives. According to the report I read in the Des Moines Register, he came away unsatisfied.
Well, we're willing to work with any, agency or governmental jurisdiction out there. This isn't about us versus them. We know that the police and county sheriffs and all the enforcement folks in Iowa do a fantastic job. It's not about us versus them. It's about looking at it from a bigger perspective and just making sure that safety is the key. And if it's about safety, then there shouldn't be anything to worry about.
Mm-hmm. Steve Gent, do you expect that some communities will have to tear down existing red light or speeding cameras?
Well, what will happen first is if these rules go into effect, and they, again, haven't yet, and we'll have to go to a legislative meeting in February, and that's actually a group of 10 legislators. It's the Administrative Rules Review Committee.
Will that be the final approval then?
Essentially, if they approve them, it'll be early February, and then in theory, these rules could go into effect February 12th. That's as I understand it right now, and obviously that could change. So first of all, there's a lot of hoops yet to go through, and I guess it's really hard to say at this point, but for any existing systems, what they need to do or what they'll be required to do if these rules go into effect is provide an annual report to the DOT by May 1st of 2014. And what that report will do is it'll look at basically the calendar year 2013. And it's going to look at the crashes, it's going to look at the speeds, it's going to look at the number of citations. And really, it's not just a report for the DOT, it's a report for all Iowans. It's a report for everybody who lives in that city or that county. And it's about just being transparent. And let's be, you know, it's to say, here's why we want the cameras. That's what we want the jurisdiction to say, is we believe the cameras need to stay because of these things. Now, the DOT is going to look at that and say, is there a safety benefit to these? And if there is, great. If there's not, then we're going to be asking a lot of questions, of course, as you would hope we would. And then, you know, we'll be looking at other potential safety countermeasures. Maybe there's something out there that we should be doing. And the DOT is not stepping away saying, we won't take a financial responsibility. We absolutely will. Again, this is the primary highway system. And on our system, we're responsible generally for paying for most of those safety improvements. And so we'll be looking at those things, too.
Steve Gent, Director of Traffic and Safety at the Iowa Department of Transportation, talking about how under new rules approved earlier this week by the Iowa Transportation Commission, cities and counties would have to prove the need for traffic enforcement cameras on major highways. Steve Gent, thanks for your time.
You bet.
Still to come on this edition of River to River, this News Buzz edition on Friday. In the second half hour, Iowa's Attorney General will join us to talk about how he and other attorneys general in the country are urging the FDA to reconsider its approval of a powerful new narcotic painkiller. Talking about the epidemic in prescription drug abuse there in the second half hour. Also, Gazette sports reporter Mark Morehouse will join us with a preview of the Hawkeyes versus the LSU Tigers matchup in the Outback Bowl New Year's Day. And finally, in the hour, we'll try to find out why it feels like mid-January, even though it's only mid-December, and what that might mean for the rest of our winter. First of all, though, let's get an update on several ag-related news items from our own Amy Mayer, reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Amy in our AIM studio. Hi there.
Hi, Ben.
Let's start, if we could, with the Farm Bill. We wanted to get a couple of other items in the door here to have you tell us about them. But the Farm Bill, you had a piece this morning on Morning Edition. It also will air on All Things Considered today. But an update. I understand yesterday the U.S. House of Representatives passed a stopgap farm measure to avert some doubling in, for instance, dairy prices while lawmakers are working on the new Farm Bill. This used to be so routine. How did it become such a hard slog with boots laden with layers of manure, if I can put the imagery on it that way?
You're right that it used to be the Farm Bill, this package of agriculture and nutrition programs, was bipartisan by design and therefore made its way pretty readily through Congress, through both houses of Congress, really generally independent of which party had the majority in either of the houses of Congress. This time around, there is much more of a divide within the Republican Party, which is, of course, the majority in the House. And there are also there's just been increased polarization in both bodies, really, which has created gridlock that we see not just in the Farm Bill, but on immigration, on the budget, on so many issues. And then added to that, there used to be, back in the 80s and 90s in particular, the use of earmarks, these little pieces of that would be added to a big bill that would help a lawmaker who was rather neutral on the bigger picture be swayed by the leadership to the leader's side. And without those, legislators have to turn to other tactics to try to get enough votes for their side.
Okay, so they could hand the earmarks out as little rewards, and now their little reward bag is empty or not as full as it used to be.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. When the Farm Bill does eventually get done, can you give us an outline of what it might look like? How it will be different than the last version?
There are a few things that seem, I shouldn't say that seem settled. We don't really know what kinds of agreements the members of the conference committee have come to. But it seems likely that the direct payments that have been a long part of the commodity title will be gone. They may be replaced with some other subsidy programs that will help farmers in certain situations.
For crop insurance?
Well, crop insurance also, there will be a crop insurance subsidy of some kind, and it also will probably look somewhat different than it has in the past. But crop insurance will become the primary safety net for, particularly for commodity farmers here in the Midwest. We expect, certainly, there will be a food stamp title. There will be a supplemental nutrition assistance program. How big it will be, what the eligibility requirements are going to be, that remains somewhat unknown.
Because there were attempts by primarily Republican lawmakers, was it, whether or not to sort of cleave that away from the farm bill, this help for the poor.
That's right. The House actually passed two separate bills, one on agriculture and one on nutrition, rather than one bill, which is what the Senate presented and what has historically always been presented. So there is still a deep divide between the House-passed SNAP measure and what the Senate is proposing. And I expect that we're going to see pretty significant a pretty significant compromise between the numbers, because the House wanted to cut 10 times as much over 10 years as the Senate was proposing to cut from SNAP.
January, is that a good estimation of when the new farm bill will be completed and passed?
That's what we're hearing now. We've been offered a lot of promises about what wouldn't be allowed to happen. It wouldn't be allowed to expire. It wouldn't be allowed to reach year's end. They are now saying January, and I think many of the legislators involved are optimistic. Yeah. I'm not making any promises, though.
Okay. Well, with the bipartisan budget deal that's working its way through Congress, you tend to be hopeful about Washington, though that may be a dangerous thing, I guess, if we jump to conclusions.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem to give one a little hope.
Let's talk about something earlier this week from the FDA, antibiotic use. Earlier this week, the Food and Drug Administration announced a new plan to phase out the use of certain antibiotics in the food production industry. What's going on here?
For quite a while now, there have been some critics of the use of antibiotics in livestock production, because these critics fear that use of these drugs is creating bacteria that are actually resistant to the antibiotics that we use in people when the people get sick. So the idea is the bugs build up a resistance because so many of the drugs are used. Then when a person gets sick with one of these bugs, we don't have an antibiotic sufficient to help the person get better.
Mm-hmm. So this is the same thing that we're doing with humans, over-prescribing antibiotics, but we're doing it with animals to a greater extent?
There's a significant difference, and that is the antibiotics that are being discussed have been used in livestock for many applications. One of those is treating individuals who are sick, which is how we use them in humans. But another is promoting growth and increasing feed efficiency, both things that can obviously help a producer get a better price for a larger size animal. But those sort of across the board uses of the antibiotics, which in many cases are mixed into the feed and then all the animals get it, that use is what is the FDA is asking producers to no longer do.
Mm-hmm. When I eat a pork chop or have that turkey drumstick, am I getting any of that?
Well, the studies have shown that ground turkey in particular is a culprit, that the antibiotic, what shows up from antibiotics in ground turkey is particularly high relative to other kinds of meats. Exactly what a person is consuming and how that impacts that person's immune response to an antibiotic is not really clear to me, and I don't know whether that's completely clear even in the science.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, the idea is that the more these antibiotics are out there at low levels in a widespread environment, the more opportunity the bacteria have to develop resistance, and that's what creates a public health threat.
Mm-hmm.
And I should mention, we're talking about antibiotics that are medically important in humans. So there would probably still be some other drugs that the producers might be able to use that are ones that are not used in human health.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, of course, in animals as in humans, it's used to prevent disease, but as a protectant to aid growth, does it promote growth? Does it make an animal grow faster, or just because a lack of disease helps the animal grow faster? Do you know anything more about that?
That's an interesting distinction, because the prevention of disease would still be considered an acceptable use of these drugs, but growth promotion would not be. So my understanding is that there was some thinking that having these antibiotics helped the animals to grow either faster or to just bulk up more.
Mm.
And I don't think that's exclusively because of protection from disease. I think there must have been something else happening metabolically to assist with that growth.
And reading in this, it's really quite incredible. I'm seeing that some 30 million pounds of antibiotics were sold in 2011 for meat and poultry production. And if we compare that 30 million pounds of antibiotics for meat and poultry. Compare that with just shy of 8 million pounds for human use. This is according to the Pew Charitable Trusts. So we use 4 times the poundage, if we say we don't usually measure antibiotics in pounds, right. But I guess we do in agriculture. Okay, four times the amount of antibiotics in our animals than we do in ourselves.
I mean, you wouldn't want to look at that data point without considering how many animals we're talking about. But it does speak to the point that the antibiotics are being used across the board in animal herds, where we would not use an antibiotic across the board in the human population.
Mm, okay. Around the world, do we have to do this in concert with other countries? I imagine so. We've got exporting a lot of pork, for instance, Turkey, I imagine, too. So is the world in concert with us, you think?
I know that there are some questions about which countries want to import what things from us in terms of our meat. I don't know in response to this particular FDA guideline what the international reaction has been. But one more thing I did want to mention is that this is a recommendation from the FDA, and it's going to depend on voluntary compliance, primarily from the major veterinary medical or veterinary pharmaceutical companies, as well as producers. Mm-hmm. But so far, there have been some of those that have signed on and said, yes, of course, we only want these medicines to be used in the treatment or prevention of disease.
So as far as any livestock farmers listening to this program, what will they notice and how soon? That's not clear.
What they would notice is that certain antibiotics that have been available over the counter for them to buy and mix into feed may no longer be available for that use, although the full implementation is not likely to be in place until 3 years from now. Also, the drugs would be labeled differently, and if a farmer felt that he had something ailing his herd, he would need a veterinarian's consultation to approve the use of the antibiotic in that herd for, you know, because there was a disease present or threatening.
And finally, Amy Mayer, in the couple minutes we have before the break, let's talk about the annual Iowa State University Survey of Farmland Values. It found the fourth straight record high average for 1 acre in 2013. So how expensive is an average acre in Iowa these days?
The average statewide value is $8,700, which is up 5.1% from last year.
Mm, okay. And this is conducted by economics professor Mike Duffy. And so up 5.1% compared to 20. How does that see if you would graph these out over the last few years? Is this a pretty average year?
It's not, actually. Only the second time in 10 years that the increase year to year has been smaller than a 10% increase, a double digit. Mm-hmm. And also Mike Duffy pointed out that most of the increase probably occurred in the first half of the year. And then as the price of corn began to come down, farmland values also started to come down.
Right.
So a 5.1% increase probably better would be described as gain. You know, it's less to be celebrated than perhaps in past years when gains have been much higher.
Okay, the real question, Amy Mayer, if I have some land, if I would have some land, where would I want to own it in the state? Where were the things shooting up? Where am I getting the highest increase?
The most valuable land remains in the Northwest Crop Reporting District in the state, although that area didn't see high gains this year. In fact, they actually saw a decrease in value, but it's because their values were so high. The highest increase from last year to this year was in the Southeast corner of the state. But again, those were lower values to begin with. So, the percentage gain looks higher.
Amy Mayer, reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in our second half hour, a preview of the Hawkeye versus LSU Tiger matchup for New Year's Day. Also, we'll talk about the weather, why it feels like mid-January, even though it's mid-December, and the Attorney General talking about his urging to reconsider the approval of a new powerful narcotic painkiller, a new drug. We'll be back with your public radio, drug for your ears, I guess. It's River to River, a NewsBuzz edition on Iowa Public Radio. Welcome back to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a NewsBuzz edition on this Friday, a chance for us to have about a half a dozen short conversations about news we didn't get to earlier in the week. Still to come, Gazette's Gazette sports reporter Mark Morehouse will join us with a preview of the Hawkeyes versus the LSU Tigers, that matchup for the Outback Bowl on New Year's Day. Also, we'll try to find out why it feels like mid-January, even though it's only mid-December, and what being thrown in the deep freeze might mean for the rest of the winter. But first, Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller is urging the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to reconsider its approval of a powerful new narcotic painkiller or require manufacturers to reformulate the drug to deter its abuse. Joining us now is Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller. Mr. Attorney General, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
You and a bipartisan group of 28 attorneys general wrote to the FDA with your concerns about the drug. First of all, before we get to your concerns, what is this drug?
It's called Zohydro, and it's a particularly powerful pain-reducing kind of drug. It can be 5 to 10 times more powerful than Vicodin, for instance, and similar drugs. So it's pure, it's stronger, it's more effective and more powerful, but correspondingly more dangerous in terms of addiction.
So it's an opioid, and it's in the heroin family.
It is in the heroin family, but of the prescription drugs, probably the most powerful of that family, and of course new.
Mm-hmm. So, what were your specific concerns laid out to the FDA?
Well, our concerns, of course, are the abuse of this drug. Over the last few years, we've seen just an enormous increase in abuse of prescription drugs, and particularly this family. And to see this drug be so strong and so powerful, and not have some of the features that have been developed in the last few years that make these kinds of drugs more resistant to abuse than they are ordinarily. What can be done is to change the sort of the composition of the pill in a way that it can't be crushed. When it can be crushed, then it can be snorted. It also can be used in a way to inject with a syringe. It's just subject to a lot more abuse if it doesn't have these qualities that have been originated fairly recently. The best example is OxyContin. It has this has these kinds of features since I think about 2000 since about 2010, and the best estimates are that the abuse of those kinds of drugs have dropped 40 to 50% as a result of constructing this drug this way. So we're saying if they're going forward with such a powerful drug, certainly it should be modified in the way that OxyContin is.
Mm-hmm. But you would your first choice and those of the others attorneys general would be to not approve this new drug, Zohydro ER?
Well, we think that's certainly a possibility would make some sense because it is just so powerful. Mm-hmm. But I think the main thrust of what we're doing and a lot of our work in this area is to modify the structure of the drug in a way that it's much less adaptable to abuse.
That's a more realistic goal, it sounds like.
I think that would be a more realistic goal. Mm-hmm. And also it would allow the drug to be used by those that really need a drug of this strength.
What is this drug used for? What conditions?
It's a pain-killing drug, and it's like the family of drugs that we refer to. It's a particularly strong one.
Now, I understand the FDA's approval ran counter to a medical advisory board's recommendation from last December, and the medical advisory board recommended what?
The advisory board had a number of concerns, but I think its main concern, its main recommendation, was to have it adapted in the way that we're describing, so that it's less subject to abuse.
Mm-hmm. Why?
And
why?
I think they had some concerns about the drug generally as well.
So why did the FDA not follow any of these recommendations?
Well, I think the FDA must have decided that this was an important drug and would provide some extraordinary benefit to those that need it the most. But we're a little mystified that even if that was their concern and their goal, which we certainly could understand, why didn't they then require the modifications of the structure of the drug that we've been talking about to lessen the potential for abuse?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to convince them. We're working on this.
Well, of course,
some United States senators have been saying roughly the same thing.
Yeah. To answer the puzzle, why they didn't follow the recommendations is Big Pharma's influence part of it?
Well, I don't know about that. I generally have a lot of faith in the FDA. We're working together with them on the tobacco set of issues. The new tobacco department is in the FDA. We worked a lot with FDA on some of the energy drinks. Mm-hmm. So we have a good relationship with them, and I wouldn't mischaracterize their motives in any way.
Because I'm trying to think, even with the reformulation, so that it couldn't be crushed, would that influence the potential profit that this company that makes Zohydro ER, a San Diego, California company, would that lessen their profits?
Well, I don't think it would, or maybe it's a little more costly to make the drug with the adaptations we're talking about, but it shouldn't make it that much less profitable. I don't think it's had an effect on OxyContin's profits. So I wouldn't think so. I think the FDA just made a mistake here, and we're trying to ask them to correct that mistake.
Okay, so you've sent this letter along with other 28 other attorneys general to the FDA. Have you had a response yet?
We have not had a response. We just recently sent the letter either yesterday or today. It actually went out. So we wouldn't expect a response this quickly.
How quickly do you
but,
think?
I would emphasize too the bipartisan nature of the letter. It's Democrats and Republicans, and also just note that the attorney generals of the country, the state attorney generals of the country, are the group that works across party lines on a nonpartisan basis more than any other elected officials. So just to give us a little plug here as well.
All right. Tell me, what is the expected outcome? Do you think the FDA will say, okay, we made a mistake?
We hope they will, that's sort of the whole desire here. We think the public will be protected the most, and will do the most to limit the terrible problems of prescription drug abuse.
Remind us in the wider context, how big we've done shows on this topic, prescription drug abuse. How big is the problem of prescription drug abuse in this country?
Well, it's gotten much larger than people think, and it sort of sneaks up on us because it's a legal product, it's a medically approved product, and the abuse just has grown dramatically over the last 5 years, such that in many places it's the number one problem in terms of drug abuse.
Okay. Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller, thank you for joining us once again. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition. And as you must have heard, the University of Iowa Hawkeye football team ended the season 8-4 and will face Louisiana State, the Tigers, in the Outback Bowl on January 1st in Tampa, Florida. Mark Morehouse of the Gazette, their sports reporter, joins us. Mark Morehouse, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Glad to be here.
Well, we already know what the chatter is about as we talk about this upcoming bowl. The only other bowl game the Hawkeye team has played in against LSU was that amazing classic battle, the 2005 Capital One Bowl in Orlando. And to start off this conversation, I wonder if you can take us back to the very end of that game and why people, and then we will know if we don't already, why we will hear this name, Warren Holloway, mentioned again and again. What happened in the final seconds? We're going to hear the play called here in a moment, but set it up for us.
Iowa was running out of time, literally running out of time. They had fallen behind I believe it was 25, 23 at the time. Last seconds of the game, Iowa needs to. The clock is literally ticking down, and I think it was a coaching gaffe, a time management gaffe, that Coach Kirk Ferentz didn't kind of own up to after the game. He kind of got a little bit growly at being asked about it, but you know, they got the miracle. I think right when the ball was snapped, I looked and I thought, hey, that guy might be open. And then I thought, oh, he threw the ball, and I thought, okay, that's an overthrow. He missed him. And then, no, it ended up being pretty dramatic.
Okay, let's listen to that. Oh, yes, dramatic. Get ready to have shivers go down your spine once again. This is Learfield Sports coverage of that. Gary Dolphin with the call along with Ed Podolak. Let's listen.
Now they got to call timeout. They wind the clock. 9 seconds to play, and Drew Tate doesn't know that. The game's going to end on this play. He fires downfield. It's caught and into the end zone. Touchdown, Iowa! Touchdown, Iowa! No time on the clock. I don't believe what I just saw. Touchdown, Iowa! Oh, my God, I can't believe what I just saw. Was it Solomon?
It was Holloway.
Warren Holloway. The forgotten man.
Warren Holloway making one of the greatest receptions in the University of Iowa school history, a 56-yard scoring strike from quarterback Drew Tate in 2005, the final play to defeat the Tigers, the LSU Tigers, 30-25. And that was really interesting, wasn't it, Mark? Because Warren Holloway was, as I think Gary Dolphin said there at the end, the invisible, he had done virtually nothing the entire season.
He had actually an okay season for an Iowa wide receiver, but this was the year where Iowa did not have any healthy running backs. They were down to the fifth-string running back, and he was a great story in and of himself. His name was Sam Brownlee, a walk-on kid from Emmitsburg, who I think he ended up leading the team in rushing with about 220 yards or something like that. That's virtually unheard of in today's football. So Iowa threw the ball a lot, so everybody's numbers were pretty good, but one little number that Warren Holloway did not have until that catch was he had no career touchdowns.
Mm. 8 years later, the Iowa Hawkeyes face LSU, the Tigers once again, January 1st in Tampa, Florida. Size up the teams for us. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about LSU this year.
They are a typical LSU team in my mind. They have a fantastic offensive and defensive lines, big, strong kids. Basically, the SEC conference, you're going to hear a lot about SEC versus Big Ten. The SEC is sitting on all year-round athletes who can play, who play football until high school football until almost Christmas. You know, they have their playoffs till almost Christmas. So, and they also have spring football in high schools down there, which is a million miles away up here in Iowa. So they have some built-in advantages, and they certainly take advantage of them. It's a beautiful team with a great athlete, great-looking athletes. They have Odell Beckham, wide receiver, who just won the Horning Award, which goes to the nation's most versatile player. He's got, I think he needs 125 yards to break the SEC's all-time total offense record, which is pretty amazing in and of itself. But one thing that LSU won't have is their quarterback, is that Zach Mettenberger, who suffered a torn ACL in the last game of the season. He's out for the bowl game. They're leaving that leaves it to Anthony Jennings, a true freshman who has just 10 passes all year long. He drove LSU to the winning touchdown in the last game against Arkansas. So he has a little bit of, you know, that was just maybe a short preview. But you know, other than that, he had whoever quarterbacks LSU is going to have a lot of support around him. Jeremy Hill, another guy, a running back, 1,200 yards, 6'2", 235, and big, fast guys. That's basically LSU in a nutshell.
Okay, so we've got the Iowa program matching them, and certainly in 2012, Iowa didn't have a great season, and at times this season, there were doubters out there, but now, as we head into the end of the season, they have really upped their game. Give us a profile of the Iowa Hawkeyes this year and how their character has changed.
Yeah, I remember last year when they finished out 4-8, it was against Nebraska, and it was at Kinnick Stadium. It was a miserable game. Iowa didn't do anything on offense. Nebraska clinched the division title, the Legends Division title. And they wore hats around, these silly-looking hats that I guess everybody gets now. Whenever anytime you win any sort of championship, the Nebraska players are wearing these silly hats. And then, meanwhile, contrasting into the Iowa locker room, I asked, okay, what steps you take? I asked the junior classman, or the underclassman, James Morris at the time, middle linebacker for the Hawkeyes. I asked him, well, what time's the first workout? And he said 6:30 a.m. Tuesday, and he knew right away. I asked another guy, junior defensive end, Dominic Alves, when's your next workout? He said Tuesday, 6:30 a.m. So I kind of thought maybe then these guys were focused on really wiping the slate clean and getting better in 2013. And, you know, they did the exact opposite. They went to from 4-8 to 8-4. A lot of growth moments for this team. I think Jake Rudek's a great story. He's a pre-med major. He's a learning machine. He's first-year starter at quarterback for the Hawkeyes and really never made the same mistake twice. Just a really focused group. The senior linebackers, Morris, Anthony Hitchens, Christian Kirksey, all great stories in and of themselves, and they really really pulled through this year, really made the team, you know, maybe made the defense more than, you know, the one of those things where one guy was good, but they all kind of came together and were made themselves better.
Mark, we have to go, but very quickly, what does Iowa have to do to beat LSU?
I think Iowa has to run the ball really well. I think Iowa, the more Mark Wiseman carries the ball, the better for the Hawkeyes, and it's kind of been the motto this year. I think Wiseman gets 25 carries, 125 yards. Iowa's got a real shot.
Okay, Mark Morehouse, Gazette sports reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Bet, thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, winding up this Friday News Buzz edition of our program. And finally, we get to a question that I've been banging on the whole hour, bugging me this week as I've been biking to and from work in temperatures ranging from the single digits to the teens. Why, here in mid-December, does it feel like mid-January? That's one of the questions I want to put to Kurt Kotenberg, meteorologist at the National Weather Service at the Des Moines office. Kurt Kotenberg, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, let's fire that one at you right from the get-go. Why is it so cold? What's behind this cold snap?
Sure. And then also, too, to help set in a little bit of the background, from December 1st to 8th, the just central region area here set daily records 506 times. And 320 of those records were for cold high temperatures, and 178 were for cold low temperatures. So we've had, obviously, lots of chilly temperatures out there. Place in Colorado, -9 for a high and -42 for the low. So to get to your question, it's kind of interesting because we have these long-range climate indicators, the ENSO and the Atlantic Oscillation and things like that. Basically, the Atlantic Oscillation is one of the big sort of patterns that we look at across the whole hemisphere, and that was actually positive. And when it's positive, it's usually warmer here in Iowa than normal. But basically what happened with that, it was positive, but it takes into account the whole hemisphere. So it kind of gets flattened out. And basically in our region here in the United States, the Pacific area of high pressure was very amplified, and the low pressure that's out to the East Coast was also very amplified. So high pressure flows clockwise around high pressure, or the winds do. And so off the Pacific coast there, we just had that clockwise flow, which is basically bringing down northwesterly winds down from the northwest, and that was really amplified. And so that basically just kept pumping colder and colder and colder temperatures down all the way from the North Pole. And that's basically what we saw here these past couple of weeks.
Right, and you dip down way into, well into Texas for for freezing temperatures. And that's fairly unusual, isn't it?
Right. Oh, absolutely. I actually spent the past 3 years in Midland, and we were still in the 70s, I remember, and I was in rollerblades last winter. And, yeah, normal temperatures down there this time of year in the 50s and 60s, and yeah, they got down to sub-freezing. So they were a good 20, 30 degrees below normal down there also. So the cold air just made it really far to the south here in the United States.
So our ground is well frozen or getting frozen. Our lakes and our ponds, our rivers are freezing over, getting a nice thick layer of ice. Well, what can we say about the rest of the winter, given what you've just described?
Sure. The way the models are trending right now is basically to stick us in a slightly normal to below normal outlook for temperatures. I've been keeping track on this each update. They update the extended forecast every third Thursday of the month. And we started out a couple months ago for the winter. The forecast was at equal chances of above normal or below normal winter. And that below normal temperature has started to creep towards the state of Iowa with every update. So it's kind of trending that way, like temperatures might be a little bit below normal. Normal highs in the winter are in the middle 30s. So odds are we'll kind of continue with that below normal trend. And then snowfall chances were still equal chances of above average or below normal. Typical snowfall for the season is right around 30 inches, give or take, mm-hmm. here in Iowa. So indicators are that we'll be pretty close to that as of now.
Okay, less than a minute before we have to go, but tell us about the weekend ahead.
Sure. Weekend ahead, looks like we'll get a little bit of a break here from these cold temperatures. Today will be in the 30s, but that break's going to be short-lived. We have low pressure coming through to the south. It's going to swing right through the Missouri-Iowa border. It should miss most of the Des Moines metro area. But behind that, colder temperatures, so we'll dip down to the 20s for Saturday and Sunday. It looks like next week, Monday, Tuesday, we'll be back in the 30s and maybe even some 40s towards Wednesday and Thursday. So we have a chilly weekend ahead, snow towards the Iowa-Missouri border. Then next week, it should get warmer back to the 30s and 40s.
Kurt Kotenberg, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Thanks for joining us, Kurt.
Sure, not a problem.
Stay warm.
You too.
All right, bye. Thanks today for production assistance from Ben Stanton. Dennis Reese helped out. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. It's River to River production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us on Monday. We'll listen back to a program that talks about criminal stalking in the state. Hope you'll join us. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Stay warm. I look around, decent ground now.